Tuesday, June 27th. Good morning, Nova Scotia. How are you this morning? Hi there. Welcome to our show today. Another great-looking summer's day ahead of us today. It is 9 o'clock. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what we've got coming up on the show for you today. Well, the cell tower is now up, but Lawrencetown residents aren't done yet with their fight against it. They now plan to take the city to court. Resident spokesman Doyle Sapphire will tell us more. We'll talk later this hour with author Gordon Pitts. He'll be launching his new book later today on the life and times of Nova Scotia's Sir Graham Day. The Last Canadian Knight is a new biography of the international businessman. As parents, school officials, and healthcare providers struggle to deal with a string of teen suicides in Cape Breton, we'll learn more this morning about a service that provides online and telephone counseling for youths. We'll hear from one of the counselors involved with the kids' help phone. After the news at 10 this morning, a new survey suggests half of Canadians aren't sure yet what to think of the newly elected leader of the Federal Conservative Party. We'll hear what Andrew Scheer is doing about that when he joins me next hour. The County of Annapolis is urging a moratorium on clear-cutting in its region, but so far the provincial government says no way. We'll talk with County Warden Timothy Habinski. Former Nova Scotia Energy Minister Andrew Younger will offer some thoughts on the latest from the Muskrat Falls Hydro Project in Newfoundland. Costs are up another $1 billion, and the cost of the power it will generate also climbing. What does this mean for Nova Scotia's electricity consumers? After the news at 11, we'll go to the phones. Another open hour coming up between 11 and 12. Well, you can tell us what's on your mind this morning. And after the news at noon, we'll hear more about this evening's annual meeting of the Canadian Association of Retired Persons and what those attending expect to hear from their guest speaker tonight, the province's Deputy Minister of Health. And our man at the movies, Local Express entertainment reporter Stephen Cook, is by this afternoon with his Tuesday cheap night look at what's playing at the movies tonight. 9:02 is our time, but first up this morning, Nova Scotians were warned last week. Tests on drugs seized by police showed a high probability of containing a medication that is used to knock out large animals, like elephants. It's called carfentanil. It's an opioid that the province's chief medical examiner says is far more potent than fentanyl, which has been responsible for hundreds of overdose deaths out west. But Dr. Robert Strang wouldn't say last week what type of drugs contain the carfentanil, nor where were the drugs seized. That's not good enough, says Amy Graves. She's with the advocacy group Get Prescription Drugs Off the Street. She calls that scare tactics and says what Nova Scotians need is help, not hype. And Amy Graves joins us on the phone to start off our day today. Amy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you doing this morning?
Good. How about you?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. I know you're in Alberta getting ready for to head off to work. It's only just after 6 in Alberta, and I appreciate you getting up just a bit early to chat with us here this morning. Amy, tell me what you can, what you know about carfentanil. How much of a risk, how dangerous is this drug?
Oh, it's certainly a risk. It's certainly an opioid. The 100 times more potent than fentanyl factor has been debated by some of Canada's leading drug safety researchers. If you remember last year, too, there was a drug, W18, that came out, and it held the same claims by the media as 100 times more stronger than fentanyl, and it turned out it wasn't even an opioid. So I would just be cautious with these knee-jerk reactions with these new formulations coming out. Everyone is so quick to want to describe something as 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more potent than fentanyl when the proper research hasn't been done on these drugs. And I have to worry if it's more of a sensationalistic factor. Definitely dangerous. Carfentanil is definitely an opioid, very potent, very deadly. But I think the sensationalism and the scare tactics are not going to necessarily deter youth. We need people to have accurate, timely-based information, but I don't think the scarier you make a drug necessarily, as we've learned in BC with the deaths increasing year after year and all of this media attention, we need help for those people, not scare tactics.
Yeah, you point out that the reference last week by Dr. Strang and the director of public security that this could be an any street drug. That's what you're referring to as scare tactics. And you don't think that will really deter people from using, especially, say, if they're already addicted.
Yes, and I don't think, yeah, it's not a positive thing. I think we should be given the truth. let people know what it's been found in, so they are aware. Just simply blanket statementing. It could be in your marijuana. It could be. They tried that in BC actually, and like I said, that scare tactic mentality of just people not knowing, therefore they're just going to stop recreational drug use altogether, is not helpful. I really think we should be reporting on samples that have been received. And I found it ironic also that in the same breath as saying, you know, we don't want to identify this because then people might think these drugs are safer than these drugs, they fail to mention any safety precautions in the use of prescribed opioids, which 93% of people in Nova Scotia, that's what contributed to their overdose death last year. Use of naloxone, not using alone, letting, if there's multiple people using at one time, have one person go at a time so somebody else can witness it. All of those safety measures when using are applicable when using prescription opioids as well, just not street drugs.
So you're suggesting, as you say, on your blog, that basically Nova Scotia needs help, not hype, and that's what we're getting, hype right now.
Well, I mean, how long has this been going on, Rick? My brother died 6 years ago. And just for instance, like when they talk about the increasing numbers have been steady since 2007. So we're looking at 10 years ago. 45 people died of an opioid overdose 10 years ago. 2012, we actually had a peak of 64 people in 2012 when fentanyl was not even an issue and just emerging out west. So this isn't some new thing, and the lack of action on this issue is actually what developed a market for organized crime to supplement with fentanyl, carfentanil, and until we reduce the demand by providing accessible treatment, harm reduction, and, you know, prevention strategies, organized crime will continue to come up with different fentanyl analogs to supplement that market.
Do you see that the province here is taking any such action at all?
It has, but too slow, especially with the introduction of illicit fentanyl. Like I said, it seemed like people dying from prescription opioids has been the status quo for 10 years, and there was little action or slow action. And now we have way more deadly, more potent made by organized crime opioids, and we don't have the services and the infrastructure intact to prevent a spike in deaths. You know, like I said, deaths have actually decreased since 2012, and I'm very worried that with the introduction of illicit opioids on Nova Scotia streets, that might change very quickly.
You've got an event coming up next month. You're calling it an Advocate for Action on the Opioid Crisis. Tell us more about this.
Sure. I'm going to be in Halifax July 22nd. We're going to be at Halifax North Common at 11 a.m. And it's more to send a statement. It's not against any one political party or level of government, because really, provincial, federal government, and a wide range of stakeholder agencies are the ones who need to act to make the things we're asking for actually happen. So for instance, we're asking for education, that we need to take all measures possible to educate the public on the dangers associated with opioids illicit or prescribed, and how to reduce their risk if they're using. We're asking for accessible treatment, including mental health. We need wraparound services for people just simply substituting opioids. It's effective in treatment, but a lot of people need additional services than just minimizing their withdrawal symptoms. We're asking for harm reduction. Nova Scotia has no supervised consumption services, and naloxone is just started to be rolled out. I've cold called pharmacies in the province asking for a naloxone kit, and some people have no idea what I'm talking about. This needs to change. We need people to be able to access naloxone, low barrier, and have it ready if they're using. We're also asking for more responsible prescribing. We need to reduce the people who are being unnecessarily exposed to opioids through prescribing. We need to reduce stigma, and we need to better regulate pharma. We don't want to see what happened 10 years ago with the fraudulent marketing of OxyContin kind of kick-starting this crisis happen again. So those are the things and more that will be advocating for. It's a demonstration. People can bring a photo of a lost loved one, a sign. We're going to be giving out GP Dots pins, you know, engaging with the public about what we do, and hopefully sending a message that there's a lot of people who have been impacted by this issue, and we want action.
July 22nd on the Common.
Mm-hmm. North Common.
All right. And you've been at this, as you mentioned, since your brother died. That was 6 years ago, I think you said?
Yes, six and a half years.
Yeah. I mean, do you think you're making any progress at all in or is this, you know, like banging your head against the wall still?
It's definitely banging your head against the wall. There's small victories. And like I said, in Nova Scotia, since 2012, deaths have increased slightly. I like to think that awareness and some of the strategies that have been implemented, I have been able to collaborate with when the Liberal government came in. They were much more open to hearing from those with lived experience and collaborating with families. So that has been a nice change to be involved a little more in consultation. But it's still, we have so much work to be done, and the crisis is evolving faster than the help is being implemented.
Indeed. And I guess one thing that baffles me is, you know, this is described as a medication intended to be used to knock out large animals like elephants. Why would a human being even want to try it?
Well, people who are already opioid dependent and currently using, it's desperation, really, in some cases. If there is an opioid that will take away your withdrawal and prevent you from being sick, it's easier to access because it's from a drug dealer, and it's often cheaper. And you can, a lot of people think, oh, I can use less and it'll get me further, when in fact it's definitely taking a higher risk than using a prescribed opioid medication, which is why safe consumption services are so important with the opioid poisonings we're seeing. So, you know, people are connecting with healthcare, they're using supervised, and somebody's there to save their life.
Amy Graves, I appreciate your time here and your efforts over these years. Thank you very much, and we'll chat again as we get closer to that July 22nd date, just to remind people of the event coming up on the North Common.
That's great. Thanks so much, Rick. Take care.
You too. Take care. Have a great day, Amy. Thanks a lot. Amy Graves, and she's with the advocacy group Get Prescription Drugs Off the Street. 9:13 is our time, and again, the province's Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Robert Strang, and the province's Director of Public Safety, Don Spicer, last week, warning Nova Scotians that this drug had been found here in this province, found in drugs seized by police, but they, again, as Amy pointed out, would not reveal which drugs contained the carfentanil or where the drugs were seized. But Donnie Spicer and Dr. Strang did say that it could be in any other substance. Spicer, for example, says that they don't want people to think that I'm safe if I take it, but I'm not safe if I take this one. It says basically, this is, again, a potent drug that even a little bit can be a risk to your health, perhaps even to your life. 9:14 is our time here on a good-looking summer's day, a Tuesday morning. How you doing so far this morning? We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this. Coming up now to 9:17, just reading about the new rink that Dalhousie University is planning, and construction of that new arena is a step closer to reality. The provincial cabinet has approved leasing a lot of land on South Street to Dal for a dollar over 75 years. It's a one-hectare site across from the IWK Health Center, and that's where Dalhousie plans to build this new hockey rink. Dal's been without a rink now since 2012, when was it that long ago, when the Memorial Arena was torn down? Says here, 2012, wow. Anyway, it's an $18 million price tag, and the money will be fundraised. And I think a lot of people looking forward to seeing, again, more rinks in this city. We can use more rinks, not closing down the old rinks. Do you hear me, City Council? 9:18 is the time right now. Well, the cell phone tower went up about 2 months ago, but residents in the Lawrencetown Beach area say they haven't given up their fight against it yet. They now plan to take legal action against the city. And to tell us more, resident spokesman Doyle Sapphire joins me on the phone here this morning. Mr. Sapphire, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rick. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, Doyle. Yourself?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Good. So this tower went up about 2 months ago, you say?
That's correct. It went up 2 months ago.
Tell us more. Again, how did they go up without, again, the citizens supporting it at all?
So this actually goes back, I think we spoke probably about 3 years ago on this matter. The residents have been involved in one form, either with the previous proponent or the current proponent, Bell, since about 2011. It's been a series of engagements and concerns being raised. We thought we had been successful when we were able to put a stop to Eastlink's proposed tower, when the city had made a staff report recommending that the tower was not conducive with the community. Bell came along later and did a similar application in basically the same area. And we had asked the city, how have you addressed the concerns raised in your first report? We never got a response to that, and then the city approved this tower.
And so now, what is it your intention here? I'm reading that you intend to take the city to court. On what grounds, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, there are two grounds for the judicial review. So what basically happened is at one time, until 2016, the siting policy required that the city councilors make a decision. They would have to either support the tower or send a letter of non-concurrence. So in the previous application, the city said, we do not support this, to send a letter of non-concurrence. What happened in 2016 is the city changed the process. So now city council does not have to make a decision. They do not have to be accountable to their constituents. That authority has been delegated to the manager or the director of planning. What's interesting in this situation is that the Bell application was initiated in March of 2014. So almost to the completion date of council having to make a decision, process changes, it's made retroactive 2 years, and a city staffer makes the decision as opposed to council.
Well, what do you think of that? Obviously not
well,
much.
Well, we feel that if you're going to start a process that lays out a process that says, we want to hear from you as citizens, we want to engage and hear your concerns, and we want to respond to those relevant concerns, then our elected officials who are supposed to represent us should make those decisions and be accountable for the decisions they make. Changing a process in the same year you're having an election and then absolving yourself of any decision-making doesn't sit well. But also applying that retroactively 2 years to an application which is already in process doesn't seem appropriate either. And we also are questioning to just review whether the city actually has the authority to sub-delegate that decision to an individual. It is a authority that's given to them by the province through the Municipalities Act, and I don't know if they have the ability to sub-delegate that to an individual. So it's a very complex issue, but there's a number of things which have allowed us to file the judicial review. And our hope is that at the end of this, that a judge will order the tower down. And if he doesn't, at least we're going to shed light on the process and some of the concerns with the process.
Yeah, I want to hear more about why you're opposed to this particular tower, but who's going to pay for this? This is going to cost some money. Is there a fundraising effort underway?
Yeah, so we have a group of citizens who have all agreed to cost the legal fees that will be associated with this. Like I said, people have been involved in this for 7 years, and so to have it end this way was disappointing. But we're also concerned that future towers could go up with this new process with very minimal public consultation.
Yes, that would be a concern, and not just for the residents of Lawrencetown, but for residents anywhere where these towers could be proposed.
Exactly. And one of the things that is very concerning is that the province is not involved. And what we think is that, Nova Scotia has a very large tourism industry. And as a result of that, there are certain iconic images, Lawrencetown Beach, the churches at Mahone Bay, Fortress Louisbourg, things that you would see on the cover of the Doers and Dreamers Guide.
Yeah.
We feel that they should be exempt from having a tower in your postcard.
Well, I recall not so long ago there was a proposal to build a tower behind those churches in Mahone Bay, and residents spoke out, and I can't remember if it was Bell or Eastlink or whoever. They quickly changed their plan and moved it to a location that was more suitable to the residents.
Right, and in that situation, the councillors there stood up and said, we're not going to approve this. And the way the process works is if you can't get agreement from the municipality, then it triggers what's known as an impasse. And only then, will Industry Canada step in and adjudicate? But often, people don't want Industry Canada involved. And statistically speaking, from Industry Canada's website, less than 0.1% of those applications reach an impasse. So in the Mahone Bay situation, it was an impasse. And in the Lawrencetown Beach one with Eastlink, it was also an impasse. But the second time around with Bell, the process changed, and now we have a tower.
Yeah. And now, what's the problem with that tower? Why is it that you're opposed to, well, the original plan and this current situation?
Well, what we feel is that Lawrencetown Beach is one of those iconic images where people go to kind of get away, to surf, to enjoy the beach, and kind of have a, you know, a piece of unspoiled Eastern Shore. It's not really conducive with the community. But having said that, we can also realize that we need that infrastructure. And the way the plan works right now is individual telecommunication companies say, well, we have a need today for a tower here. So there's not a strategic plan. We would like to see a plan that the province is involved with that says, hey, we have a mandate to expand broadband to all Nova Scotians. How do we do this strategically? How do we do this to ensure maximum coverage by coordinating the other proponents, at the same time protecting areas that are of natural interest or tourist interest to Nova Scotians? So by having a plan, we can achieve both those goals. Nobody is anti-tower. You know, we all need telecommunications as a fact of life today. But what we need is a strategic plan that enables that goal, but at the same time respecting communities and respecting some of the natural wonders that we have as Nova Scotia that we market as far as our tourism industry.
Indeed. Is there a date for this judicial review, or have you made the request yet, or tell me more?
Yeah, so the request was made, it had to be made shortly after the October decision, and we've been through a lot of the preliminary court motions already. So we now have a trial date for November of 2017. And at that time, they'll make a decision whether the letter of concurrence in the process was valid. That puts us into a gray zone because the authority for the towers is federal, and the federal government declined to be involved or a party to this review. They did say they would respect the jurisdiction of the courts, so it'll be interesting to see if the courts order that it shouldn't be up, what happens next. But regardless, I think as a community, we want to hold our representatives accountable, and we want to make sure that people are aware of the process and the faults in the current process.
All right. I appreciate the update, Doyle, and we'll talk again, probably get closer to that November court date then, and appreciate your time here this morning.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Rick.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Doyle Sapphire. He speaks for the residents out in the Lawrencetown area who are unhappy with this one, Bell, and the previous application had come from Eastlink, but Bell put up a cell phone tower 2 months ago, and those residents will continue to fight that. And as he said, they're going to court to seek a judicial review and hopefully get the judge to overturn the decision. Coming up to 9:27 here on a good-looking, great-looking summer morning. How are you doing? We're going to take a break here in a moment. We've got a news update coming up for you at the bottom of the hour. After the news, we'll have a conversation with Pitts. He's an author of a new book that's out. In fact, he'll be launching the book later on today at 11:30 at Dalhousie University. The book is called The Last Canadian Night, The Unintended Business Adventures of Sir Graham Day. Sir Graham Day, of course, a Nova Scotian who's done very well for himself, thank you very much, on the international business scene. And we'll hear more from Gordon Pitts on his book when he joins us after the news. We'll also talk later in the half hour with a counselor from the Kids Help Phone Service, a service that provides assistance, help for kids that may be in some distress. And we'll talk with one of the counselors and find out more about the service that they provide. A busy Tuesday ahead. I hope you'll stay with us. We'll be back with more after the news, and that is coming up next. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. Later this half hour, we'll talk with a counselor from the Kids Helpline. As folks struggle with a rash of suicides in Cape Breton of basically young teens, and as a result of bullying, it seems, we'll talk with a service that does provide help for kids who are in some distress. It's called the Kids Help Phone, and we'll talk with one of the counselors. He'll tell us more about the service. She'll join us later this half hour. After the news at 10 this morning, we'll have a conversation with the new leader of the Federal Conservative Party, Andrew Scheer. Will join us, and we'll hear his reaction to a new survey out that suggests that, well, over half of Canadians really have no idea who Andrew Scheer is. We'll ask him what he's doing about that. He'll join me coming up next hour. We'll also have a conversation next hour with former Energy Minister Andrew Younger and a new report out on the cost of the Muskrat Falls hydro project in Labrador. Costs are up another $1 billion, and the cost of the electricity that it will generate also on the rise as well. So what's all of this mean for Nova Scotian consumers? We'll hear from Andrew Younger on that issue coming up next hour. After 11 this morning, we'll open up the phone lines to hear what you've got to say this morning. An open hour between 11 and 12, where as always, anything goes. And as always, there's lots we could talk about this morning. Hope to hear from you. We'll hear from Bill and Gordon Karp after the news at noon. Karp, the Canadian Association of Retired Persons. They've got their annual general meeting this evening, and they'll be listening to a speech from the province's Deputy Minister of Health. We'll ask Bill what they expect her to tell them tonight. He'll join me coming up over the noon hour, and Stephen Cook is here over the noon hour as well. Local Express's entertainment reporter with his Tuesday Cheap Night look at what's playing at the movies tonight. 9:34 is the time right now. Well, author Gorton Pitts will be launching his new book later this morning. The book is called The Last Canadian Knight, The Unintended Business Adventures of Sir Graham Day. Day, of course, an international businessman. He was at one time British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's so-called privatization ace. He's also, by the way, a Nova Scotian who graduated from Dalhousie University. And Gorton Pitts joins me on the phone this morning to tell us more about his new book. Mr. Pitts, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you doing today, Graham?
Things are good.
I'm glad to hear. I like the title of your book, The Last Canadian Knight, The Unintended Business Adventures of Sir Graham Day. What are you telling us with that headline?
Well, Unintended is really the story of Graham's life. He didn't have a chart. He didn't have a plan. Things happened to him. And being a very intelligent man who took advantage of opportunity, he just went from one big job to another. It shows you the power of being in the right place at the right time, but also being able to seize these things.
Well, and also he was a very smart and intelligent man as well. And he was like chairman and CEO of British Shipbuilders, chairman and CEO of the Rover Group, and that was in the UK. Chairman of Hydro One in Ontario. Boy, he's been around.
He is probably the most traveled executive that Canada has produced.
So what kind of individual is he? I mean, when he started off in the business world, he really didn't have a plan at all?
Well, I think that's true. I think he had a huge ambition, and he was very bright. But, you know, he started as a kid from North End, Halifax, and kind of was a nameless kind of adolescence. He was the kind of guy who was basically dispatched to the washroom to hang out with a bunch of ne'er-do-wells. And he found himself at Dalhousie, and he discovered a mission in life, and then he went with it. I think that happens to a lot of kids. It takes a while. And the jobs started to come. He was a small-town lawyer in Windsor, Nova Scotia. He went from there to Canadian Pacific, an unbelievable jump, and then to becoming the most important executive possibly in Britain during the Thatcher years.
Yeah, what was it about him that attracted Margaret Thatcher?
I think he's tough-minded. He's a very tough-minded guy, but he comes with a certain charm. He's Nova Scotians and Canadians in general do fairly well in Britain. They're not Americans, which is a big advantage. Yeah. They don't come with that built-in confidence that they can do everything, although Graham was pretty confident. And they have an appreciation of British norms and mores and history, which Graham brought. He's a great reader, so he brought with him an understanding of British society. He was a dual national. He was his father was born. He was a Cockney from East End, London.
Oh, so from, again, rather common roots, this man now, again, knighted by the Queen. What year was that? 1989. So obviously he had an impact on Great Britain.
He has a lasting impact on Great Britain. He was kind of an outsider. Outsiders often do. They see the flaws in the societies. They see the opportunities. And I know Thatcher is a very controversial figure, but he found in her a leader who would let him do his job. Once she was confident that he was a tough-minded and able, she left him alone, which was kind of unusual for Margaret Thatcher.
Indeed. What is about his role here in Nova Scotia? What about his accomplishments in this province?
Well, I think he's been a tireless supporter of the region. He sat on the boards of the major industrial companies, many of the major industrial companies, Sobeys, the Jodry group of companies. He was a lead director of Bank of Nova Scotia, which has terrific Halifax roots. So he's always been sort of not just an idle cheerleader, but really rolled his sleeves in to make this region punch above its weight.
Now, what got you interested in Sir Graham Day?
Pardon?
What got you interested in writing a book about Sir Graham Day?
Ah, yes. About 12 years ago, I wrote a book that profiled the maritime business leaders. I've had a lasting, long interest in this area. Graham was one of the people I did a mini profile on, and out of that came an interest in the region, and I've done a couple of biographies now. Don Mills, who is a local researcher, pollster, has worked on this for 10 years to persuade Graham, because it is one of Canada's most fascinating business stories. It's a voyage, and I was hooked on his story, and Don worked tirelessly to get the project off the ground.
Okay, and Graham Day living here in Nova Scotia again now. In fact, he's a lawyer at the law firm of Stuart McKelvey.
Yes, he was counsel with Stuart McKelvey. He's just stepped away from that role. He's in his early 80s, part of his impact on the region has been his role at Stuart McKelvey as a mentor to young lawyers and to handling some of the really tough files that came into the law firm's purview. So Dalhousie and Stuart McKelvey have been kind of his home basis since he returned 25 years to the Maritimes. He did come home. He lives in Hansport today in the valley. He's very much, his life is a circular life. He got a big help from a lawyer in Stuart McKelvey early in his career that set him on his way, and then he came home to do service for them.
Yeah. I'm curious as to why perhaps he didn't step into the realm of politics. Was he ever interested in running for politics?
He was approached a number of times, and he's a man who likes to control his own fate as much as he can. I think he quickly felt that politics would have been too controlling. He does not like to see people control his life or control his decision making as tightly as party discipline would have required.
So he'll be at the book launch. It takes place at 11:30 this morning. I'm just looking at it's at Dalhousie University in the Row Building, the atrium of the Row Building. Again, it runs from 11:30 until 1 this afternoon, and I understand that Sir Graham Day will be there this morning, will he?
Yeah, he will. Graham is very eloquent. He's very keen on the project. We had a great time doing it, and he'll be speaking.
So what kind of outside of, again, his expertise as a businessman, what's he like as just a person?
There's an aspect of Graham Day that's not known by a lot of people. He is a consummate musician, a fine baritone who was considered actually by the Gilbert and Sullivan troupe in England.
Wow.
He was music director of an old TV show. A number of us will remember Sing Along Jubilee.
Okay, yeah. He was part of that.
He was part of that. He was in the chorus, and he directed the musical activities on that show. He's got a wonderful voice, but also keen musical talent, and he can hold forth. I understand musically at the right time in the right place.
Well, he clearly had a remarkable life, and it should be very interesting to read the book, dear Mr. Pitts.
Somebody just said the other day it's a page-turner. That's the best compliment. I hope that's true.
All right. And again, the book will be officially launched this morning at 11:30. at Dow University's Row Building in the atrium, and Gordon Pitts, the author. I appreciate you sharing a few moments with us here this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. Good luck this afternoon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Gordon Pitts, again, the author of The Last Canadian Knight, The Unintended Business Adventures of Sir Graham Day. And again, 11:30 to 1 at the Row Building at Dalhousie University in the atrium there, at the official book launch of The Last Canadian Knight. All right, coming up to 9:44 here on a sunny Tuesday morning. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more right after this. 9:46 is our time. Youth mental health expert Dr. Stan Kuchar is among a group of healthcare providers in Cape Breton this week, trying to help deal with a string of teenage suicides this year. Three youths have taken their own lives. It's being referred to as a crisis. The three attributed bullying as the reason for their suicides. There are supports in place for teens in distress, including the Kids Help Phone. It's a 24-hour-a-day service. Caitlin is a counselor with the Kids Help Phone, and she joins us on the phone this morning to tell us more about the service. Caitlin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. And it is a policy with the Kids Help Phone not to fully identify, so that's why we don't know your last name.
That's right.
Indeed. What's the reason behind that, by the way?
Just to protect the identity of the counselors.
Okay. Again, we see what's going on in Cape Breton. There was a public meeting last night. A couple of hundred people turned out to that. They say that the response from the community has been overwhelming, but the issue is, what do we do about these kids who have taken their own lives? And you have a service, the Kids Help Phone, that does mm-hmm. provide that kind of help. Tell me more about the Kids Help Phone.
Well, the Kids Help Phone is a 24-hour professional counseling service for any youth across Canada. So we speak to people about all sorts of different things. It could be related to suicide, but it could also be everyday things that young people are going through that they would like a safe space to feel heard, to talk about that issue, to get support, and then maybe to also get some resources to find out what else is available in their community that they may be able to access.
Yeah, bullying, again, appears to be the reason for most of these suicides, at least the three in Cape Breton anyway. So if somebody calls you up and to say that they're being bullied, what kind of help can you offer them?
Yeah, we get a lot of calls, unfortunately, related to bullying. And if someone is calling and facing bullying themselves, they're a target of that, we would talk about how they've been feeling around that, what maybe they've been doing, how they've been trying to access support or to manage that situation. We would help them identify other supports that they could reach out to, so teachers, parents, friends, other allies within their community or within their school. We would also really address the emotional health aspect, so how that person was really coping with that. Oftentimes when people are facing bullying, they might be very isolated and they might not actually seek support and may be dealing with a lot of those emotional feelings alone. So when kids call us, it's their opportunity to really talk about that, to feel heard, to not be judged, and to get that support that they may need to sort of figure out what the next steps may be for them to take.
Yeah, I wonder if they're calling looking for help, or they're just looking for someone to talk to right now.
Pardon me, what someone was calling?
No, I say, I wonder if they, when they call, if they're actually expecting help or they're just hoping that they'll have someone to talk to.
You know what? A little bit of both. Sometimes people are calling directly looking for tools and tips and sort of strategies, ways that they can cope better. And other people, they don't really know maybe what they want at first. They just know that it doesn't feel good to keep this inside, and they want to be able to stay anonymous and confidential and to share a little bit about their story and to sort of go from there. So often those conversations do lead into conversations about, okay, what can you do now? And here are some strategies for dealing with that. But it definitely can start off as, I just want to talk because I have no one else to turn to.
Yeah, and I suppose that they're at their wits' end, basically, if they, again, pick up the phone and call you guys. Is that fair to say?
Is it fair? Sorry, I'm a little hard hearing you.
That's all right. I'm saying, you know, if they're calling the Kids Help Phone, then I'm suggesting they're at their wits' end. And is that a fair assessment, that these kids are basically, they don't know where to go, who to turn to, who to speak to?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes we might be their first place that they've ever reached out to, maybe the first time they've ever spoken about anything that they're experiencing. And other times it could be that they have supports in their life, but there might be certain conversations they may be afraid to have. They don't know how to have those conversations, maybe afraid of the repercussions of that. A lot of people, which is, you know, often why people don't reach out for help, there's a lot of course, stigma that's associated with that. So oftentimes if youth don't know where to turn to, how to have that conversation, how am I going to say this? Is this going to be taken seriously? Am I going to be judged? Are people going to treat me differently? There's a lot of those sort of feelings that go into that. So when people reach out to an anonymous and confidential service like ours, they know that they don't have to share identifying information. They know that they're going to be calling someone who is a professional counselor who can talk about what they're going through and free of judgment. You know, they're in the driver's seat when they call us. We don't, you know, we're not directive. We don't tell them what to do. We're here to support them and empower youth to really make decisions and choices that fit, you know, what is working for them and their needs, and supporting them and kind of going through the pros and cons of some of the choices they may be making.
Do you, have you ever received a call from someone who was threatening to take their own life? And how do you personally deal with these kinds of things?
Yes. Suicide is a call that we do get lots about, whether it be someone who has intentions or whether it's in maybe early stages of suicide ideation, but also from people who have lost someone to suicide, friends who have witnessed changes in a friend's behavior, or maybe a friend has come out to them saying that they're having thoughts of suicide. So we really speak to sort of all aspects of that. But if someone were calling in distress, just what we would do over the phone is, first of all, a thorough risk assessment to sort of assess their environment. Do they have intentions today? What's sort of going on for them right now? Possible triggers that may have led to that. And really trying to de-escalate that person and to provide that safe space for them to talk about those feelings. In some cases, we do need to make a referral and, you know, get that person immediate support. So we would gather their information and be able to send them an ambulance or connect them with other resources that can immediately help them by coming to their house or wherever it is that they are. But oftentimes when people are calling and they have suicide ideation, they may not necessarily have a plan. They may have been, you know, thinking about suicide for a very long time. And it's not necessarily all the time that a person wants to die as much as they want that pain to sort of end. And suicide sort of feels like the only way of accomplishing that. So that hopelessness, that sense of, you know, there's nothing else that is going to help, that's what we really want to focus on, to help youth to understand that that's not the case, that there are supports, there are ways of overcoming that, you know, reaching out to people and really instilling that hope that sometimes people don't feel. And it could be a result of numerous things, not one thing in particular, but numerous things, such as you've identified before, maybe bullying, a lot of, you know, sometimes family struggles at home, a lot of different factors that can contribute to that. So we would also explore and talk about that.
Do you have your own children, Caitlin?
Do we have our own program?
No, do you have kids yourself?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay, I was wondering if you were a mother of a child, what you're thinking when, you know, a 13 or 14-year-old calls up to say they're thinking about ending their own life.
I can only imagine, you know, what a parent might be going through. But I can certainly say the youth that call here, that is a huge source of strength if someone decides that despite feeling that way, they actually want to talk about it and get support. So you know what? When someone calls in and they say that, we want to go from that good place. We want to go from that place of what brought that person to want to talk about this. That conversation can be hard to have. That can be difficult for a parent to have that conversation. But you know what? It is so important that parents, that friends, the school, you have these conversations about mental health and specifically about suicide. Talking about suicide is not going to make someone more likely to commit suicide. If anything, it could bring down the walls or the barriers that may exist for that person by helping them to see that this conversation is okay to have, that you're a safe person to talk to, that you can actually talk about this and it be taken seriously, and then have that person support you in getting further help. So that conversation is so, so important. So as difficult as it may be, it is strongly encouraged. And even when kids call here, we ask those direct questions. Have you thought about suicide? Are you feeling that way right now? Do you have a plan? These are questions that need to be asked.
Well, and again, we had lots of conversation in recent times about suicide and whether we should be talking about it in light of comments from the police chief, who says that they're thinking about releasing monthly suicide statistics as a means of continuing the conversation about suicide.
Continuing the conversation about suicide absolutely is important. I mean, the mental health conversation in general, and not just about suicide, but emotional distress. There's a lot of things that start off as, you know, very, you know, common thoughts and feelings that without proper support or community involvement or without, you know, addressing these things sort of early on, they can develop into, you know, much worse things. You know, depression, for example, is something that is fairly common. And, you know, if someone is experiencing depression on top of, you know, other environmental risk factors, it could be, you know, again, either environment at home, at school, presence of bullying. It could also be, you know, combined with, you know, things that youth are going through. So, you know, also, you know, questioning their identity, you know, just going through, you know, everyday regular struggles combined with also maybe an existing mental health issue that has not been diagnosed or not been addressed really. You know, you're creating sort of a situation where youth now is dealing with so much, and, you know, making sure those supports are available and continuing to have that conversation so they know that if I am feeling this way or something doesn't feel quite right, it's okay to talk about it and with who, and that in doing so, I'm taking the first step to getting that support.
Indeed. Counselor Caitlin, I appreciate your time here this morning. I should, again, pass on the phone number, a 1-800 number, should anyone feel they have a need to talk to someone like Caitlin here. And that number is 1-800-668-6868. 1-800-668-6868. And that's the toll-free number for the Kids' Help Phone. And Caitlin, thank you very much here this morning. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You as well.
Bye-bye. Counselor Caitlin, a counselor with the Kids' Help Phone line. And again, just one more time, I'll pass on that number. It's 1-800-668-6868. Just about 9:58 here now. We've got a news update coming up for you in a couple of minutes. After the news at 10, a conversation with the new leader of the Federal Conservative Party, Andrew Scheer, will join us. We'll also talk about the increasing costs at Muskrat Falls with former Energy Minister Andrew Younger. And an open hour coming up after 11. Stay with us. We'll be back with more after the news, and that's coming up next.